Hi, this is Circe Olson Westner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking to author Les Arbuckle, who is a Navy brat. Or do you prefer Navy Junior? Anyway, welcome, Les.
Navy brat is fine. I think brat pretty much describes the way I was as a child.
So we're going to talk about your book today and a little bit about you. But in doing some research, you know, we just released a book ourselves. But in doing some research, I see Saigon Kids was a number one new release in Military and Wars on Amazon when it first came out in 2017. Why do you think it had such an appeal right off the bat?
Well, as far as I can figure out from my research on the internet, there's around 10 to 15 million military brats or former military brats in the United States. But in looking for books or memoirs by military brats, I found nothing but a few self-published books. So Saigon Kids was probably, as far as I know, the first military brat memoir published through traditional channels. You know, you get an agent, the agent finds a publisher, the publisher publishes the book and puts it out for the entire world. I looked for years trying to find military brat memoirs. There was nothing. So I think that's one reason it kind of got off to a good start.
Well, I'm going to jump right into another question then that I want to revisit later on. And that is the fact that you got an agent. I know many military brats and spouses who are writing are looking for agents. So really quickly, how did you find yours? I guess we'll ask the question now instead of waiting for the process.
Through the traditional routine of querying literary agents all over the United States, pretty much. And, you know, New York and LA are the big hotspots, of course, but you mail out a letter, you know, outlining what's going on in your book and asking for, if they're interested in representing you. And if you get one back that says, okay, then you take it from there. Mostly you're going to get rejections. And I did.
Was your agent a brat or a vet or a spouse?
No, but he did represent a lot of military history. That's kind of his specialty, military history. The problem with a lot of literary agents is when they hear the word Vietnam in your query letter, that immediately shuts down their interest because they think, well, we've heard it all before. They think of choppers and rice paddies and Viet Cong and incoming and mortars and all that stuff. My book wasn't about any of that, really. My book was not about grunts in the field and rice paddies, which is what so many of the Vietnam War books were about. But as soon as they saw that word Vietnam, I think it shut down their interest right there. I even had one agent said to me, oh, this has been so done. You know, it's like, really? I've been looking for a military brat book for years and nothing, not even about military brats in Italy or Paris or Germany.
Right.
So it hasn't been so done.
Well, let's get back to your book. Yeah, I've heard that before a couple of times, but let's get back to your book. So it takes place in the 60s. Your dad was a chief petty officer in 1962-63 when your family joined him in Saigon. What was he doing there?
Well, in 1962, in the summer of 1962, we had already received orders to go to Pensacola, not Pensacola, we were living in Pensacola, to go to Puerto Rico, to the naval base there, and we had gotten all the vaccinations, and then suddenly they changed my dad's orders, and they wanted him to go to Saigon and set up the radio equipment on the roof of the Rex Hotel and start broadcasting as Armed Forces Radio Station Saigon. So he went ahead of us, and we got all new vaccinations for Vietnam again. And we joined him in early January of 1963. We had to leave my big brother Lee behind because he was too old. He was no longer a military brat. He was, he had matriculated, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
And, so we flew there. My dad got there in the summer of 1962, went up to the roof of the hotel, and there were big packing crates full of radio equipment. And the Navy provided him with a couple of technicians to help set everything up. And then he ran the station alone for 3 months. He did all the programming. He did everything from early in the morning to late at night for 3 months until they finally got somebody in there to help him. He was the head cook and bottle washer for everything. So the first show that he started was the morning show. I think it was 6 to 10 in the morning. It was called the Dawn Busters Show. And if you see the movie Good Morning Vietnam, the show that Robin Williams is doing in that movie as he plays Adrian Cronauer is the Dawn Busters Show. And my dad created the show. And I think I've heard also that my dad created an attitude at the radio station that was not so military, because my dad, he really wasn't a hardcore military man. He was a jazz musician. He was a drummer and was in the military because he needed to support a large family. But the attitude around the station had always been, you know, we're going to do something for everybody. So they had people like Adrian Cronauer come on. And what Adrian was doing was for the new generation of soldiers that were coming into Vietnam that wanted to hear rock and roll music. They wanted to have that that rebellious, disrespectful kind of attitude towards the authority. And he kind of personified that, as you see in the movie.
So as a 14-year-old, what did you think? You were on your way to Puerto Rico. Now you're on your way to Vietnam. What did you think about living in Vietnam? And had you lived overseas before?
Well, I had lived overseas. Ironically enough, it's where you're living, Hawaii. We lived in Pearl Harbor in 1956 at McGrew Point. I didn't really know what to think about Vietnam. I could barely find it on a map. It was called French Indochina at the time. Mm-hmm. And we looked it up on our globe at home. And the only thing I really knew about living in Asia was the little bit I had seen in the previews of a movie called The World of Susie Wong. So I imagined us living right downtown in a large metropolis. And when we got there, we lived out in the suburbs. Well, suburbs is kind of a loose term. They were all townhouses. But I had no idea what it was going to be like. I loved it when we got there. It took a while, you know, it took a few weeks. But once I got there, I discovered a world that I had not even known existed, really.
Had you paid attention to the Vietnam War prior to moving to Saigon? Did you have an inkling of what was to come?
The most attention I have ever paid to any politics at that time was to the Cold War, which we heard about constantly, of course, and to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was taking place not far from where we lived in Pensacola. But Vietnam was not on my radar. Mm. You know, I had heard little or nothing about it. So I was completely in the dark about what was going on.
Well, so in your book, you know, you mentioned events literally ignite around you. So what did you experience?
Yeah, we moved into a very volatile situation. There had been terror bombings and attempted coups before we arrived. What we got to witness once we had gotten there were more terror bombings. They bombed the Kindo Theater when my friends were there. They bombed the ballpark. There were other attempted bombings and an occasional grenade throwing into a bar. There were Buddhist immolations. The first one, I was a witness, but I only really got a good glance at it. It was not far from my house. And we eventually lived 2 blocks from the Palace of Nho Dinh Diem. When the coup d'etat happened, the tanks were literally rolling on the streets in front of my house. And it scared the hell out of all of us, especially my mother, who was very, very nervous about everything.
So how long did you live in Vietnam?
We were there 18 months, January of 63 till June of 64.
So things were moving very rapidly. I mean, that sounds like a lifetime. All of the things you just described, it sounds like that should have been 4 or 5 years, but it was really condensed into a flashpoint almost.
Yeah, there was never a dull moment in Saigon. We were always warned by our parents, be careful. And if the cab, never to tell the cab driver where you wanted to go, instead to give him directions as you were going there, which meant if he did not follow those directions explicitly, we were to open the doors and jump out of the cab, even if it was moving.
Wow.
Because they were worried about us being kidnapped. And indeed, one of my friends was kidnapped. I found out about this recently. Mm-hmm. And fortunately for her, the cab driver was stopped by some American MPs who had a checkpoint going over a bridge leading out of Saigon. And she was rescued. But she was the only one I've ever heard of being kidnapped. But it was always a constant fear.
Wow. So you moved away from Saigon. You moved back probably to the States. But as you grew up and the Vietnam War dragged on, how did your feelings about the war evolve? I mean, did you start off believing in it and then change, or did you not believe it? Anyway, what were your emotions about the whole Vietnam conflict?
Well, I really didn't know what to believe when I got there. You know, I had heard about the fight against communism and all that, like everybody else had. But when I got there and saw what was going on, I kind of started to figure out that the South Vietnamese were not going to win because they were not motivated. The Viet Cong were motivated. They would do anything to win, and the South Vietnamese wouldn't do anything to win. They kind of depended on us and the French. But one thing I've thought about since then is, had the North Vietnamese respected the division of the country into two parts in 1954, North and South Vietnam, after the fall of Dien Bien Phu, had they respected those lines, there never would have been a Vietnam War. But they wanted to unite the whole country. So instead of what we have in South Korea and North Korea right now, we have a united Vietnam, mm-hmm. Which is really, the South is not really very capitalist at all. For instance, if you want to open a business in Saigon, you don't need a permit. You just rent a space and throw up your shingle, and there you go. In the United States, of course, where we are capitalist, allegedly, you have to go through a big permitting process to open a brick and mortar store anywhere. Mm-hmm. So even though the North was very communist, and I think ideologically they probably still are more communist than the South, in a way, the South Vietnamese won the war because that's where the prosperity is in Vietnam. It's in the South. It's not in the North.
Huh. So I read on Amazon, which is where people can buy Saigon Kids, that there's a documentary film sponsored by the New York Foundation for the Arts currently in production. And according to the description, the film chronicles the lives of military brats living in Saigon in the volatile years from 58 to 64. Who's making the movie? Is it out yet? And are you involved in it?
I was involved in it. It's being made by Elvira Rousseau. She's been working on it for 12, 14, 15 years, a long, long time. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure it's ever going to be done because she just keeps on adding stuff to it. Mm. You can't interview everybody. You know, at some point you got to say, this is the end, and go from there. She might get it done, but I was interviewed for it several times, and once in Arizona, once here in San Diego, and once again in Los Angeles. Mm. And my brothers were interviewed at the same time when we were out in Arizona. I don't know if she's ever going to get it done. She might, you know.
Wow. Well, it sounds like it will be interesting if it does get done, or maybe pieces and parts of it will get accomplished. So I know that your book is a memoir, but I would imagine you had to do additional research in order to get the pieces and parts, because you were a kid. So obviously your memory may not be as, detailed as you probably wrote in your book. Did you do other research?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And one thing I learned while doing all my research is that memory is a lie. Whatever you remember is probably not 100% accurate. For instance, I wrote about the coup d'etat scene. starting out, that's the first chapter in my book. I thought it was an exciting place to start. I wrote about it, wrote down everything I remembered about it. And then I talked to my brothers and they remembered it completely differently. So I had to go with what they remembered, you know, for part of it, because my memory, I just did not remember it all. I also used Stanley Karnow's book, The Vietnam War, to get some of the dates, you know, when was the coup? When was exactly, when did things happen in Saigon? What was the date the ball field was bombed? What was the date the Kendo Theater was bombed? And the internet, you know, the internet's a marvelous tool for doing research. You can find out so much. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I even put on music that I was fond of at the time that I had heard in Saigon to help stimulate, you know, nostalgia, which is basically memory plus emotion. So, you know, I spoke to some of the other brats that I had been friends with them because the internet allowed us to do so, you know. So, yeah, it was tough, though. I wrote the book based on what I remembered mostly, you know. When I first wrote it, I knew nothing about writing. I had never written, the only thing I had ever written was a 500-word article for a jazz magazine. But I just sat down one day and started writing out every story I could remember about Vietnam that I thought was interesting or meant anything at all. Then I put them in chronological order, and then it got difficult. So writing is... I write pretty well now, but I didn't write well when I started. Not 95,000 words worth of well.
Well, I was going to ask then, how did you decide? You know, you said you started in chronological order, but obviously you probably rearranged. How did you piece together memories and history into a book that actually flowed and well and read well? And then what did you edit out of the book?
Well, after I had written everything and struggled with it for a few years, I sent the whole manuscript to an editor in Seattle named Ann Minnie. Mm-hmm. And I sent her a nice check along with it. And she had it for a couple of months. And then she sent it back to me with just tons of notes, just everything. She criticized every period, comma, everything. And she gave me a really good literary beating. And after that, I went through and I edited the entire book according to what she had said, you know, using her criticism as a guideline. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get an agent after that. But the editing continued. I continued to go over things and rewrite it, move it around and change this word and change that word. And it was a long process because I was learning how to write. I didn't learn in a master's program at a university. Mm-hmm. I learned at my own, sitting in front of the computer and listening to what Ann Minnie told me. And she was right. She was a really good editor.
Wow.
Some of the stories I left out, one of them I put on my website called My Matrang Vacation, about a vacation we took when we lived in Vietnam. It wasn't in the book, but you might want to read that. It's amusing. I left out some other stories. There's one on that website also about the Superman contest, which has nothing to do with Vietnam, but it does have a lot to do with my family and the dynamics of our relationship. But one of the things we edited out at the insistence of my editors at the publisher was some of the language we teenage boys used at the time. So you can imagine how teenage boys in 1962, 63, 64 talked, and we did. And the way we talked would not be considered politically correct today. But in memoirs, I'm all in favor of telling it like it is, you know, just laying it out there, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So, but they got their way. So,
you know, the editor was saying, now, would you like your mother to read this?
Well, yeah, that's in a way, you know, my parents died young, so they never got to find out about all the crap that I did. Mm. And I told my daughter that she can read it when she's 40. So, but yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily being proud of it or anything or ashamed of it. This is the way we were. And the things I did as a kid, teenage boy in Vietnam, all the teenage boys, 95% of them were doing the same kinds of things. Staying out late, smoking, drinking, trading money on the black market, going to brothels, you know, just misbehaving, you know, getting in fights with the local kids, because the local kids were not going to leave you alone. You know, it's like every military brat knows what it's like to be the new kid in the school. Mm-hmm. And a lot of military brats find out what it's like to be the new kid in a country where you're not separated. There's no bubble. We didn't live on a base. We lived right smack dab in the middle of the population. So a lot of the other kids, you know, in the population, they probably had the same kind of fights with us as they did with the French kids that lived there before us. So it's the way it was.
So shifting gears, besides Vietnam, you mentioned Pensacola. Where else did you live as a brat? And where did you like the best and also the least?
The best was probably Hawaii. Well, Vietnam was the best, but Hawaii after that. The San Fernando Valley, when I got there after living in Vietnam, seemed like the dullest place on earth. It was literally Leave It to Beaver Land. And I say literally because the kid that lived three doors down from us in Reseda, California, mm-hmm. was an extra that worked on the set of Leave It to Beaver. He was one of Beaver's friends.
Wow.
It was a three-bedroom, two-bath homes as far as the eye could see and strip malls. And after Saigon, it just seemed like, what, you know, where, when is Rod Serling going to step out and tell me that I'm in the Twilight Zone?
What kind of student were you in school? And did you have any, did you join any extracurricular activities?
Well, in Saigon, they had a band at school, actually, a small band, mm-hmm. Led by a woman, Jacqueline Schaefer was her name. Mm-hmm. And she did the best she could with our limited instrumentation. There were probably maybe 20 kids in the band, had a lot of flutes, a few trumpet players, a couple of saxophone players, me and another kid, and a guitar player, her son. So I participated in the band as soon as I found out I could. And then I was on the bowling team, and I still have my first place bowling trophy from high team bowling trophy from the Saigon American Community High School bowling team. So
wow.
Yeah, we were really hot.
Well, so with all of your diverse experiences, hold on, my doorbell is ringing. I have to answer. I'll be right back. This is the beauty of Zoom. So sorry about that. The doorbell rang and it was a neighbor with telling me that I had left my garage door open. You gotta love military community life. So we were talking about where you ended up going to college or joining the military. Did you do either or both?
I did both. My father retired in 1968, and my parents and my two younger brothers moved from where we were living in Norfolk, Virginia, to Phoenix, Arizona. I didn't want to move to Phoenix. I had graduated from high school. I was classified 1A by the draft board. I wanted to go to Berklee College of Music in Boston. I had no idea how much it cost, but I knew I didn't have the money. So since I was going to be drafted, if I didn't join, I joined the Army Band and went to the School of Music at Little Creek and then Fort Monroe, Virginia, and got a guarantee for the band at Fort Monroe. After that, I stayed around Norfolk for about a year and then moved to Boston to go to Berklee, and graduated from Berklee in 1977.
So you joined the Army Band then?
Yep. It seemed like a better option than carrying a rifle and a rice paddy.
I'm going to veer a little, but is it very, very competitive to get into the Army Band?
At the time, it really wasn't. You know, they had five Army bands in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They had Army bands everywhere. They had an Army base. Mm-hmm. So they needed musicians. And I was actually, I auditioned for the Army Band on saxophone and on upright bass. I had been first chair upright bass player for all city, all regional, and all state band in Virginia in 1968. And I figured if they didn't take me on one, they'd take me on the other. And they said they'd take me on either. And they said, if you want to play bass, you're going to have to learn how to play tuba so you can march. And I could just see myself marching around in the 90 degree heat with a tuba wrapped around me. And I said, no, I think I'll play saxophone. And so that's what happened.
Well, the tuba would have ruined your embouchure, you know, for this. Well, does that make sense? I mean, I can see them telling you.
In retrospect, I should have gone on and played tuba and upright bass, because a good bass player is more in demand than almost any other musician. Because it's not a glamorous instrument. Nobody wants to play the bass, but everybody needs one.
Well, and speaking of that, you became a professional musician after the military. How long were you in the military? And then let's talk about your professional career as a musician.
I was in for most of 3 years, and I didn't like it at all. I was tired of being told where to live by the U.S. government. Since I had been told where to live by the U.S. government my entire life, I just wanted to be free. And when I got out, it may have been the happiest day of my life up to that point. And the second happiest day of my life up to that point was when I arrived in Boston and said, you know, I think it was late August of 1973. Because there I was in Boston, had the GI Bill and a place to live. I could do whatever I wanted to. And what I wanted to do then was play music and learn music. Totally music centric.
So, did you join a band or tour or?
In Boston, I played for the first 6 months. I didn't play anywhere. I didn't know anybody, but I started playing around Boston, started playing in strip clubs and Latin bands and whatever little jazz gigs I could get. And as soon as I graduated from Berkeley, I went on the road with the rock musical Grease. We did the West Coast from San Diego all the way to Vancouver. And that was my first experience, not my first experience being on the road, but my first experience being on the road in a union situation where you were paid as a professional and you traveled like a professional. And it didn't pay a lot, but it paid pretty well at the time. And it was a lot of fun. So
was touring life what you thought it was going to be, or?
Yeah, maybe a little more boring than I thought it might be, but because we were playing, a week here, a week there. I think we played about three or four weeks in Los Angeles, which was interesting because I had lived in LA as a kid, in Reseda. And so I started going to the beach. My girlfriend came and hung out with me in LA. I sent her a plane ticket, and we had a 1 month vacation, except for that 2 hours a night where I had to do the gig. But that was the fun part. But basically, being on the road, you get to see a lot of hotel rooms and venues. And unless you stay in one city for a long time, you don't get to see a whole lot else. So it's not really the instructive educational experience it might be.
It's not like going on a going sightseeing and then
right where you go and see what you want to see. It's you're confined to a certain time frame and locale, and then you go to the next place and you're confined in the same way. So you get to see some, but not as much as I saw in Vietnam, for sure.
So I was going to ask you the best part of being on the road and the worst part, but I think the boredom and the confinement is the worst part, huh?
Yeah. The best part is you get to play every night. You get paid especially if you're on a union gig, and you get to hang out with some pretty interesting people sometimes, so that's the good part. And you do get to see a certain amount of the sights.
So what else did you do besides Grease?
I worked with a lot of Latin bands in Boston. When I got back to Boston after getting off the Grease gig, they offered me a cruise ship gig, which were easy to get back then. But I didn't want to go out on cruise ships anymore. I had a girlfriend to think about, who eventually became my wife. And I went and got a job teaching at Berkeley. So And that precludes doing a lot of traveling, really. So mostly I played around Boston a lot, you know, played every job imaginable you can think of. And there were a lot of them in Boston. Boston was a very musical town, partly because you had Berkeley there and the New England Conservatory right down the street and the Boston Conservatory right next door. And then Harvard and MIT and Northeastern all had music departments, and BU, they all had bands. Mm-hmm. So it was probably the richest musical environment you could be in, except for maybe New York.
Wow. So is there anything you want to share about becoming or being a professional musician for our listeners? Now, somebody's out there, some kid like, I'm going to grow up and be in a band.
Well, I like to tell them you can't do both. Pick one.
Oh, you can't grow up or you can't be in a band?
Right. Take your pick, you know. Mm-hmm. The music business has changed so radically from when I was a kid that it's almost unrecognizable. The opportunities are few and far between, and they are reserved for only the most talented or the people who are ready, willing, and able to do marketing full time. Mm-hmm. In the past, you wanted to get hooked up with a good agent or a good band, go on the road, make some records, tour a lot. Now you're lucky to get a gig more than one night a week anywhere. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I got out of high school. I worked 7 nights a week, plus 2 jam sessions on Saturday and Sunday in the summer at the Bedford Inn in Norfolk, Virginia, 7 nights a week, all the way from June through October when I quit to join the Army. Mm-hmm. I came back to the club in January after I got out of basic. Same band was playing there 7 nights a week. They played there for 8 months, 7 nights a week. You can't get a club gig these days for more than 2 nights anywhere unless you're famous and rich, which means if you're Brian Setzer, you can. Right. If you have a good band, if you're really well known, maybe then you can get a week somewhere. Back then it was ordinary, you know. You set your equipment up in June, you take it down in January.
Wow, I can't imagine 7 nights a week. I mean, family life must have been non-existent.
Well, you live family life in the day. You worked at night. I remember reading a thing by an older musician talking about how he used to come home from the gig in New York at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the entire family would get up and they would all have dinner, because that was when he got off work. He had dinner, just like you and I do now. Generally, military families do. Got up and had dinner 1 o'clock in the morning. Then the kids would go back to bed and mom would get them up at whatever time they'd go to school. For him, dinner was after the gig, just like it is for most working people. Breakfast was when he got up to go to the gig.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Like the night shift now, you know, like hospital night shift.
After I got out of the Army, we had a gig 7 nights a week, mm-hmm, at the Lido Inn from 9 to 1. And then across the street at the Lamplighter from 1:30 to 5:30 in the morning, 7 nights a week. We did it for 13 weeks. Wow. So I ate breakfast after I would eat breakfast after I got off work, you know, at 6:30 in the morning. And then I would go to sleep and wake up and eat dinner at 5:30 in the afternoon. I didn't see the sun for months.
Wow. Yeah, it doesn't sound as glamorous as it looks in the movies, for sure. But again, if you love it, you know, then you're happy doing it. I mean, that's the thing about work, you know.
Yeah, that was great then because I was 22 years old, you know.
Right, right. So speaking of 22, it's now 2021. What are you doing now besides writing books?
I surf a lot.
Ah.
Which Hawaii has great appeal for me in that respect. But I live about 4 miles from some of the best surf in Southern California. So I usually get out there about 6 o'clock every morning I can. I fix saxophones. I still play an occasional gig now and then. Mm-hmm. I don't do 7 nights a week, not unless the money is really good. And I'd really rather not work 4 hours a night. A 2-hour gig is about all I want to do anymore. Other than that, I've got a book I'm working on. A novel set in Boston's combat zone, which is where all the strip clubs were. And it's about a saxophone player, strangely enough, who falls in love with a stripper, and they get involved in some things they shouldn't get involved in.
Wow, that'll be interesting. When do you think that's going to be done?
I've gotten to the end. I'm editing now. It's going to be very different from anything I've ever written. And I'm not even sure I want to put my name on it.
You'll have to think of a really good pseudonym.
I've been thinking about that. So
interesting. Well, that's cool. You know, and I just interviewed somebody and said, you know, you write about what you know. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, all of the stuff that's going to happen in this book, but as a saxophone player and, you know, a musician and working in that kind of environment, you know, that stuff.
Yeah, all the characters in the book are based on people I actually knew a little bit sometimes, even though they didn't necessarily act like the people in the book. All the people in the book are basically bad. You know, there's no real heroes in the book. Even my protagonist is not a real hero. You know, you can understand why he does what he does, but he's not a hero, you know?
So, I was reading your website, and I want you to give the URL here in a little bit, but both your book and your work repairing saxophones have gotten some very impressive reviews from some actually well-known people. What are you most proud of when you look at the comments?
Well, you know, the saxophone business, I started that about 25 years ago. I got tired of teaching, and there weren't really enough gigs to call it a living. So I thought I'd give it a try, and it turned out that I liked it better than teaching. The clock seemed to move faster when I was repairing than when I was teaching. And I realized I can pretty much make a saxophone do what I want it to do, but I can't make a student do what I want them to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to, you know, hope and pray generally. Mm-hmm. But I'm proud of both of them. You know, the book was a little bit, the book was unique to my experience in life, because I never imagined myself being an author. But back around the turn of the century or so, I realized that nobody had written about this stuff before, the military brat experience. Mm. And there's millions of military brats. Why has no one written about it? And I thought, well, somebody's got to write about it. I might as well be the one. You know, I'm a good reader. I read 100 books a year, probably.
Wow.
But I figured if I don't do it, who is? If not me, who?
You know, that's interesting. That's how the museum got started. I was wondering who was telling the military spouse's point of view and the military mom's point of view. And I said, well, maybe I ought to start a museum. And because nobody else is. And I'll tell you, you know, sometimes these ideas just take fruit, and, you know, you say, oh, I'll do it. And then you put it out in the universe. And even though you have no plan or knowledge of how to do it, you do it. That's how you started your book. Oh, well, maybe I should write a book. Oh, I don't know how to write a book. And a lot of people would quit. You know, they'd say, okay, yeah. No book.
Yeah.
But you didn't. And you pieced it into something that really a lot of people have gotten great pleasure out of reading. And I think that's to be commended. And I know there are lots of military brats that I, you know, talk to or I read on the board, you know, on the listservs and on the Facebook groups that talk about writing a memoir, but they never do, or they don't do it. What would you tell a budding writer about writing their memories?
Well, the two most important things I'd say, one, find a time to write every day. And at that time, every day, sit down and write. Even if you write one word, sit down every day and you stare at that computer screen or piece of paper or whatever you're writing on, and you write and just write it down. Don't edit it. Don't even think about it. Just write everything down that you can. If it's a memoir, just write down what you remember. And the second most important thing is get to the end. Mm-hmm. Get to the end of the story, because that's when the work starts. First, write the whole story. Get the whole story down. Don't worry about misspellings or punctuation or flow or anything like that. Just get to the end, because there's more half-written books out there in the world than there are completed books. If you imagine that there's a billion books that are completed, there's probably more than a billion that are just half completed.
Right. I just gave that advice to a brat who's writing a book now, saying don't edit in the middle, because you'll get overwhelmed and you'll just get discouraged, you know.
Right.
What is it? Paralysis by analysis.
Right. Yeah. You get bogged down in the details, and then it's like you can't see the forest because you're in the trees.
Yeah. So in the few minutes we have left, is there anything you'd like our listeners to know about you or your book or your new book or anything?
Well, there's an audio version available if you're more inclined to listen to the book in your car while driving.
Oh, you mean Saigon Kids?
Yeah, there's an audio version of Saigon Kids, an audio book available. You can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Nobles, wherever. It's read by a professional book reader, I guess you would call him. And also, I've written a screenplay, and I'm looking for somebody that has $10 or $12 million burning a hole in their pocket to produce the screenplay. It got a good mention, good honorable mention in the Beverly Hills Screenplay Contest. And what I need is somebody that wants to produce it, you know?
Wow. Is that on Saigon Kids too?
Yep.
Yep.
Saigon, yep.
Wow. Very interesting. See, I didn't know any of this. As I just looked at your website and said, okay, I know this and this. And now I know that you are a screenwriter.
The good thing about the screenplay is that I fictionalized it. So I changed things. So in the end, I get the girl.
Nice.
So like kids, it doesn't quite work out that way.
I would ask you who you want to play these parts, but that might ruin it.
Well, Leonardo DiCaprio is still probably young enough, since he looks like he's 14 all the time anyway.
Yeah, well, there you go. Hey, question. Are you allowed to mention who your agent is, or is that like a no-no?
It's Roger Williams of the Roger Williams Agency. I don't know how much work he's doing lately, though. I think he's kind of semi-retired. I don't know. Could be wrong.
Okay. So you can buy Saigon Kids on Amazon, but also at any bookstore. You can ask your bookstore to
Barnes and Nobles, Books a Million.
Yeah.
Any place that sells books will have it.
Okay. Well, very cool. Well, Les, this has been a great conversation, despite it being interrupted in the middle. I really appreciated having you on the podcast. And it's been fun.
I appreciate you having me on. And it's a great thing you're doing with the museum. Somebody had to do it. And yeah. you got the call, I guess. So
Yeah. Just like
good going. You know, there's millions of military brats out there, and they need to know they haven't been forgotten.
Yeah.
I'm sure some of them have had the same experience as I have.
Well, thank you for that. So as always, I'd like our listeners to know that the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. Thank you so much, Les, once again. It's been awesome.
Thanks for having me, Cersei, and we'll see you in the future, I hope.
You will.
What a trip.